I'll leave you with this Cat Power and be back next week. Thanks for tuning in this week. Take care.
Welcome to Warning Shots here today on CKUW 95.9 FM. I am joined in studio by Alana Lajoie O'Malley today. Hi, Alana.
Hi, Alex.
And we are going to be interviewing Alana Mitchell, the author of Seasick, Crisis in the Global Oceans, a bit later in the show. This has been a week where we have seen lots of ocean-related disaster on the eastern seaboard, with Hurricane Sandy, and I myself, I went commercial fishing out on Lake Winnipeg, so it's been a very watery week. And maybe, Alana, you could reflect on what you've seen with Hurricane Sandy this week.
I actually have family out of New York, so I was getting sort of hourly updates on lack of utilities and on cars underwater and the East Village in New York City, and sounds like some pretty intense stuff going on out there.
And my experience with the water this week was going fishing with Bill Buckles on Lake Winnipeg off of Deer Island, and it was its own little swashbuckling experience, riding around on a skiff. And the interesting part about Lake Winnipeg is that it is afflicted with the same issue as we're going to be talking about here with Alana Mitchell, and that is you say the word because I never get it right.
Eutrophication.
And that is what causes the algae blooms from the phosphorus dumping. And there's a lot of issues related to that in the ocean. But without further ado, we are going to jump into the news briefs and get this issue of Warning Shots going. These are your news briefs. Rolling Stone and Bill McKibben report, only 565 gigatons of carbon are required before we reach the end of our carbon budget, which means before we experience a global meltdown. 2 degrees Celsius is the maximum scientific limit, and we're actually three quarters of the way there already. Meanwhile, scientists have identified 2,795 gigatons of carbon in our proven reserves, those owned by oil and gas companies already, which means peak oil of fossil fuels will not prevent us from irreparably damaging the conditions for human civilization. And this does not even include shale or bitumen reserves. Weekly news update on America reports Mexico's Miguel Agustin Pro Javeres Human Rights Center held a press conference in Mexico City on October 23rd to announce the release of a report on the alleged torture of Israel Arzate Meldendez, a resident of Ciudad Juarez in northern state of Chihuahua by state police and the military. According to the report, tortured, imprisoned, and innocent, two soldiers arrested Arzate on February 3rd, 2010, charging him with participation in the massacre of 15 youths in the city Villas, Villas de Salavacar neighborhood the previous January 30th. The report says soldiers took Arzate to the military installation, stripped him naked, tied up his hands and feet, placed plastic bag over his head, and tortured him with electric shocks to get him to confess to involvement in the killings. On October 24th, government officials deny that there is systemic use of torture by police and the military. AllAfrica.com reports the brutal actions of Nigeria's security forces in response to Boko Haram's campaign of terror are making an already desperate situation even worse. Amnesty International said in a report released today, the report, Nigeria Trapped in a Cycle of Violence, documents the atrocities carried out by Boko Haram as well as serious human rights violations carried out by the security forces in response, including enforced disappearance, torture, extrajudicial executions, the torching of homes, and detention without trial. Grave human rights abuses have been committed by Boko Haram, including murder, burning down schools and churches, and attacking media houses and journalists. At the same time, security operations targeting Boko Haram have been concluded with little regard for the rule of law or human rights. We are going to jump into some music while we get Alana Mitchell on the line. We're going to start off with Mercy, Mercy Me, The Ecology by Marvin Gaye, and then we're going to go classic Canadian rock with Nautical Disasters by The Tragically Hip from The Day for Night. A bit of a mix, but that's what you get.
Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh,
things ain't what they used to be. Lost, oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. Radiation underground and in the sky, animals and birds who live nearby by the night. Oh, mercy, mercy, mercy. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more will you from me? Can't you stand?
And welcome back to Warning Shots. That was The Tragically Hip with Nautical Disaster. And now we're going to be interviewing Alana Mitchell on her book, Seasick. It's a book that details a whole bunch of the different intersecting crises that are happening with the ocean right now. Not only is it climate change related, but there's many other different issues going on with the ocean to produce a very sick global ocean. And I'm going to let Alana do the rest of the talking about what is going on with the ocean. Alana, are you there?
I'm here, Alex, yeah.
Thank you very much for coming in with us today.
That's my pleasure.
And don't get too confused, the co-host is also named Alana.
Hi, so. Alana.
Hi there.
And I'm going to let her start off this conversation about why we should be concerned with the health of the ocean.
So, Alana, I kind of have maybe it's a bit of a silly question, but one that I think is sort of relevant to us here in Manitoba. You know, here we are in the prairie provinces. We're pretty much as far away from an ocean as you can get living on this planet. And I'm wondering, what does the ocean have to do with us here in the prairies? You know, aside from kind of my general interest in the well-being of you know, people and the planet, how does what's going on in the ocean affect an ecosystem like mine?
Well, I grew up in Saskatchewan, so I started off with some of the same questions. But the truth of it is that all the life we have on our planet is dependent on the ocean. So, it's your ecosystem is intimately connected to the chemical and biological functions that the big global ocean is providing for the planet. So the way I came to think of it was to think about, you know, if you think about the whole planet as a body, if the ocean is unhealthy, it's like the blood in your own body being unhealthy. It affects every single other part is how I came to think of it. So, I mean, one of the scientists I spoke to, whose name is Boris Worm, he teaches at Dalhousie University in Halifax, explained to me that, and this just totally blew my mind, I just didn't, you know, understand how important the ocean is to life on Earth, but he explained to me that if everything on land were to die tomorrow, everything in the ocean would be fine, in fact, better. But if everything in the ocean were to die tomorrow, everything on land would also die. So we're intimately connected with the health of the ocean.
Well, if that's the case, why do we talk so little about oceans, or why do we hear so little about them?
You know, I think it's for a couple of reasons. I mean, you know, I think it's partly because we live on land and we breathe air. So, if you live on our planet, you either live in water or you live in air. And because we live on air, and because we're, we talk to each other, we don't really think about all of the power, the biological and chemical power of the ocean, and it's become this invisible thing. I mean, to me, when I started writing this book, Seasick, I had really only thought of the ocean as, you know, the source of fish that I ate, or I thought of it sometimes as the place where the beach hit up, you know, or I thought about it, you know, as the historic way that civilizations or populations had spread across the planet or vanquished other people's navies and stuff like that. But I never for a second realized how important it is to the survival of life on the planet.
That's a really, really important segue into understanding why everyone here, even on the prairies, needs to focus on climate change's effects and the way it's transforming the ocean. And I'd like to ask you, how does carbon dioxide through greenhouse gas emissions affect the global ocean?
That was the other thing that surprised me so much, because, you know, we hear so much about climate change and we hear about, you know, like the drought this summer and the, you know, all the effects we are expecting from this high carbon world that scientists have begun to talk about. But it turns out that even though the carbon, the ancient carbon that we're putting up into the atmosphere when we burn fossils, even though it turns out that that's affecting the climate, it turns out it's affecting the ocean even more, and it's even possibly more serious than the effects on the climate. It's in my thinking about it, I realized that what the scientists were describing was almost as if the primary site of the planet's cancer or illness is in the atmosphere, but the even more dangerous, the metastasized site is in the ocean. And the reason it's dangerous is that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, of course, holds heat against the body of the planet and holds, you know, and is altering climate. But when it gets into the ocean, it's actually reacting with ocean water, with you know, the marine environment, with water itself to create carbonic acid. So it's chemically reactive in the ocean, and it's making the ocean more acidic, which is, you know, really hard to do. You know, the ocean is set up so that it doesn't change chemically very easily, and we've put so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that it's, you know, been absorbed to such a degree in the ocean that it's actually changing the pH of the global ocean. Astonishing.
And so what does a changing pH mean for the ocean?
Well, a couple of things. Many things that scientists have identified, and a whole bunch that they haven't yet, but the basic problem is that the creatures that pH is, or acidity, is one of the fundamental descriptors of anything. So you have a pH in your body, and all your listeners do. And I mean, one of the first things they do when a baby is born is figure out what that baby's pH is to make sure that it's within the normal range. But normal range for almost any system is quite narrow. So what we've done is change the ocean is 30%. The surface water is 30% more acidic now than it was when we started burning fossils. So that was about 250 years ago. And that's a huge change in a very short period of time. So the big problem is that it's disconnecting the creatures that live in the ocean and that evolved in a stable pH from their evolutionary history. What that in particular means is different for different creatures. So if you need to make teeth or bones or shells, or if you're a coral reef and you need to build all those bony structures, you're using a combination of calcium and carbon in the ocean water to create that stuff. And it turns out that in a more acidic ocean, that calcium that's in the ocean isn't available to creatures that need to make those structures, not as available. So it's harder and harder for creatures to make shells and bones and teeth and other kinds of things. So already in the cold parts of the ocean, where there's been more absorption already of carbon dioxide, we're seeing little creatures that have pitted, thin shells, and that phenomenon over time will become more and more pronounced as we put more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and as the ocean becomes more acidic. So that's one of the main things. But you also see fish that don't know, like their sense of smell is affected somehow by the pH, and so they become stupid. They swim toward their predators instead of swimming away. And you see oyster embryos on all up and down the west coast of North America being badly affected by the pH because they're not evolved to deal with it. Other creatures do okay. Some of them are going to be fine.
So what are the implications for human life specifically from the warming ocean that we really need to be attentive to?
That's one of the great questions. I mean, I can answer only in the abstract because it's we know that fish populations will probably be affected. So it could affect food supply for the planet, protein supply, that kind of thing. We know that as creatures have more difficulty making their shells, they may not be as good buffers for things like storm surges and things like that. But those are sort of practical issues. On a more philosophical and more abstract level, you know, really the issue is that as we alter the chemistry of the atmosphere and the ocean on the planet, what we're doing is recreating the conditions that existed during the last five mass extinctions on the planet. So there have only been five. The last one was when the dinosaurs died out. But if you look at, for example, the one 250 million years ago that scientists called the Great Dying, because 95% of the species on the planet went extinct at that time. If you look at that one in particular, there was a very similar, it's considered a good analog for today, because carbon dioxide went into the atmosphere very, very rapidly, and there was a huge effect on on the ocean. The ocean became acidic, it became warm as it is now, and it developed, you know, great swaths that had little or no oxygen. We're recreating all of those conditions right now on our planet at a faster rate than happened during the Permian extinction, as it turns out. So the overall abstract issue is that we're setting the table for a mass extinction, and which creatures will live and which creatures will die is an unknown, but it's, you know, the life on the planet responds well to stability, and what we've created inadvertently through all this carbon dioxide gas in the atmosphere and the ocean is a situation that's very, very unstable, and that's just not historically been good for life.
You're describing here a lot of images that sort of bring to mind those apocalyptic movies that you know, I certainly grew up watching, and certainly this week, that's something that a lot of images have been sort of coming up out of New York in particular, that people are going, wow, this looks like the movies. And I'm wondering, you know, after all this time you spent studying oceans, what your thoughts and reactions have been watching Hurricane Sandy and sort of what's been going on all over the eastern U.S.
Yeah, I mean, and the big question, of course, in everybody's mind is this climate change? Is this what happens, you know, when you put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, or, you know, how much of it is that and how much of it is natural? And it's a really interesting debate that scientists haven't sorted out yet. So it's, you know, the scientists I've been talking to and reading about this have been saying that probably a component of the ferocity of Sandy was related to the high carbon world that we've created. So you had warmer water starting out, you know, where the hurricane started out, and then it picked up speed because of that. And then, as I understand it, Sandy hit another couple of different systems once it hit land so it became a hybrid freak storm. And some of the scientists are saying that it may be that the ferocity of the storms that combined with the hurricane to create this Frankenstorm, those could have been exacerbated by some of the Arctic cold air coming down, because Arctic ice is not on the ocean in the same way. So it could be that there was a component there. But, you know, the thing that kept running through my mind is that, you know, what New York and New Jersey and the Eastern Seaboard went through is precisely characteristic of what scientists have been saying will be more and more frequent. So whether it was 10% climate change and 90% just bad luck or, you know, natural variation, or whether it was 50-50 or 100%, the thing is that's we're going to have to expect that kind of thing much more as the carbon in the atmosphere and the ocean becomes more intense.
The best description I've heard for what's happening when it comes to climate change was by a NASA scientist, Jim Hansen, who said that it doesn't predict any particular weather. What it does is it changes the colors on the side of the dice that you have for weather creation. So you have more sides of the dice which have become extreme cold or extreme heat or extreme storms, and less sides of the dice that are patterns of stable weather.
Right.
Is what I've heard.
It's that whole stability thing, and this goes to the whole thing. You know, this is one of the great challenges from people who don't know very much about the science behind it to the science of climate change. They say, oh, but you know how it's just weather, and weather always changes. Well, of course, weather always changes, but the point is that we're talking not about weather, but we're talking about climate, and the difference is that weather is what you get, and climate is what you expect. And the thing is that the expectations are changing, and that's what's so critical, because when expectations of weather change, that means it's really hard to know when to plant. It's hard to know when to reap. It's just we don't necessarily know where ports are going to be, and roads and sewers and things like that, because things are changing and really quite rapidly if you look through the timekeeping lens of the planet. I mean, this stuff is very, very quick. And it's anomalous. I think, you know, one of the things that surprised me the most when I started looking at the numbers on this stuff is just the level of anomaly of what's happening. So we know that the ocean hasn't been this acidic in at least 55 million years. We know that the atmosphere hasn't had this much carbon in it in, you know, tens of millions of years. this is not just a little variation. It's a massive, massive change in a generally stable system.
So, I mean, that's something to really be concerned with. But I want to bring us back to a very different topic. It's a hard transition here rather than a soft transition. And I wanted to know from you, moving back to understanding human interdependency with the ocean, how should humans understand our relationship with plankton in the global ecosystem?
I thought plankton was the stuff that looked pretty at night.
That what?
That, you know, when you swish your hands around in the water at night and the water is sparkly, right? That stuff.
Some plankton are bioluminescent. That's what it's called. They make their own electricity, and it's incredibly cool when you're... I've been very, very, very deep in the ocean, like to 3,000 feet in a submersible, and as we were coming up in this submersible, of course, it's pitch black down there, and as you're coming up, just the movement of this vessel coming back up to the surface created all of this bioluminescence. It's the most magical thing I've ever experienced. So, yeah, plankton are, but other creatures do it too in the ocean. Plankton, humans are, it's a funny thing because we don't think that we depend on plankton, but plankton, which are little phytoplankton, which are little, you know, little plants that live in the ocean, are responsible for at least every second breath of oxygen that you're breathing right now, even on the prairies. It's astonishing, isn't it? And they're also responsible. They help to control the carbon cycle. They help to control the nitrogen cycle on the planet, and of course the oxygen cycle. So they're, you know, all of these things that we see looking around us in this, you know, as air breathers, are to some degree dependent on these little microscopic creatures that live in the ocean.
And how are they doing?
Well, that's a big unknown question. There have been a couple of studies that have shown that they're not doing very well, and the thing is that they not only drive, you know, the food web on the planet, but they drive these chemical processes. So it's been the subject of enormous amounts of research, and there are some studies, including one by Boris Worm, the biologist at Dalhousie, who are saying that there's a big decline in the numbers, but that's just one study. It's unclear. That one of the big concerns I know among the plankton biologists I study is that many plankton, so probably about half of them, have little shells made of calcium carbonate. So just like just the same stuff that is, you know, makes a coral reef, or makes, you know, the White Cliffs of Dover, for example, or the shells from little coccolithophores, which are a type of plankton that still is very, very common in the ocean. So those little shells are made of the same stuff that is, you know, that is going to be hard to make in this more acidic ocean. So one of the big questions is, what happens to all of these cycles that plankton are in charge of if they can't make their shells? And it's a complete unknown. We just don't have a sense of what will happen. Will a naked plankton, in other words, still make oxygen in the same way, still fix carbon in the same way, still cycle nitrogen? Unclear. And it's one of those things that, you know, sitting here as just a journalist looking at it as a citizen, I think it would be really great to know this stuff because a lot depends on it.
So I'm interested to know a bit more about a certain type of plankton that we're seeing a lot more of in certain places, and that's Cyanobacteria blue-green algae, and its relationship here to Lake Winnipeg is a big issue because we have I can never say this word.
Eutrophication, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So Lake Winnipeg has that, but we're at a good spot now where it's actually increasing fish stocks. I'd like you to describe where that process is in, say, the Gulf of Mexico, and how that's created.
Right. So what you're really talking about is an algal bloom. So that's what happens when the plankton, the phytoplankton in the ocean, or in a lake like Lake Winnipeg, has too much food. So the big algal bloom that was just created off the coast of Haida Gwaii, for example, in BC, that was created by adding iron to the ocean, so plankton just went crazy. That same phenomenon is happening in a whole bunch of other parts of the global ocean and in some lakes as well, like Lake Winnipeg. And the phenomenon is just that there's too much food for plankton. So eutrophication actually means too much food. Lots and lots of food is what it means. And so to a certain point, the system that these algae or these phytoplankton are in can absorb it, and that's what happens if there's fish. So if there's a lot of fish, enough fish to eat the algae, then that's all good, right? It's a system that's supporting more fish, and that can be beneficial. Eventually, of course, it gets to the point that there are way too many phytoplankton and not nearly enough things to eat them, and that's what's happened in the Gulf of Mexico and in 406 other described parts of the global ocean where we've got what's known as a dead zone. So it starts off with way too much phytoplankton in the ocean. In the case of the Gulf of Mexico, this is from all of the plant fertilizers up and down the Mississippi River that are put on crops like soybeans and corn and stuff, and there's way too much and it's not being used properly, and so this stuff goes into the Mississippi watershed and sweeps down to the Gulf of Mexico and starts to feed plants in water instead of the corn and soybeans further north. And so it feeds all these phytoplankton, and they go absolutely crazy. This is like the best deal ever if you're a phytoplankton, right? Because it's like the buffet, the all-you-can-eat buffet. They just go nuts, and they reproduce like crazy. There's nothing to eat them, and so they fall to the bottom of the water column, to the very seabed, and that's when the second part of the process takes over. So the first part is called eutrophication. The second part is called, what happens is the bacteria start to decompose all of these extra phytoplankton, all of these extra algae, and they, as they do that, they use up the oxygen in the water column. So right from one little spot on the bed at the bottom of the seabed at the Gulf of Mexico, at the mouth of the Mississippi in the Gulf of Mexico, spreads every year this immense, immense dead zone. They call it the blob. The scientists, I spent about 2 weeks on a research expedition looking at this thing a couple of years ago, and the year I looked at it, it was like 22,000 square kilometers in area, and that doesn't include its volume. So in a whole bunch of parts of that big swath of water that has no oxygen, it goes right from the bottom of the seabed right up to the top of the surface of the water. So what happens is that it has literally almost no life. Like no fish can live there, no crustaceans. It's a graveyard on the bottom, and things that can get out of that water with no oxygen just simply bug out. They move to different parts of the global ocean, further out. But it's the most eerie thing because, you know, we were on this expedition looking for creatures and trawling and looking for things that were even microscopic, and there was just absolutely nothing. It's an astonishing phenomenon. And so that phenomenon is happening in 407 parts, discrete areas of coastal waters in the global ocean, as well as in places like Lake Winnipeg.
So that sounds like a lot of areas of the ocean where you've got these massive dead zones, and I'm wondering what does that do for fish stocks? And also maybe I'm just wondering about sort of the migration of different species and how that's sort of changing ecosystems in terms of the predator-prey relationships and things like that.
It could easily change them, and I haven't seen a study that's looked at that. I mean, in the Gulf of Mexico, which is probably the best studied one, the fish and things just move further out. So fishermen in the U.S. are still in that part of the U.S., coastal waters are still getting as many fish, but they have to go way further out to get them. So they just move out of the place that they have been, that they normally live in. It's not clear what's happening in some of the really huge swaths of the global ocean that are in bigger currents systems. So there's a great big one off the coast of Oregon and Washington, another big dead zone that was only described in 2008 for the first time. And it's unusual. It's one of three in the coastal waters that really has scientists worried. Because if a scientist looks at Lake Winnipeg or looks at the Gulf of Mexico and looks at the algal blooms and stuff there, a scientist realizes, you can say, okay, this is what's causing that. You can point to the source of it. But if you look off the coast of Oregon, and there are two similar ones in two parts of the coast off Africa, you can't point to a single source for them. In those cases, those dead zones are being caused by changes to the current system and by global warming. So climate change is actually causing these dead zones in the ocean in three places that we know of. And if you're a scientist looking at that, you're really scared, because if there isn't a single source, and if it's caused by something like global climate change or global planetary disruption, then how do you stop it, right? And that's the big worry with these three dead zones, the three of the 407 that we know about that have been scientifically described. So that's a worrisome trend.
So, considering all of these different trends that are going on with the ocean, what type of ocean with global warming are we looking at in the future?
Well, over time, I mean, if you really took this to, to an endpoint, you'd have something like what happened during the Permian extinction. So that's when 95% of the species on the planet went extinct. So you had all of the warmth in the atmosphere, but you also had an ocean that was warmer. Its pH was quite low. I don't think it was as low as what we're expecting by the middle of our century, actually, if we continue to put carbon into the atmosphere in the way that we are now. And it also had these zones of low oxygen, these anoxic or dead zones that we were just talking about. So it had those three components, and those three are considered to be greater than the sum of their parts. So when you have not just ocean acidification, but also ocean warming and also dead zones, scientists call this an ocean that is warm, breathless, and sour. If you have that kind of an ocean, then you have an ocean that doesn't support life as we know it.
So one of the things that I think is really interesting about your book, Seasick, and even listening to you talk today, is you're sort of taking a lot of this language and a lot of descriptions about oceans that are very technical and very dry, and you're sort of trying to create this more visceral experience for people through your work. And I'm wondering what you can say about what role that kind of genre of writing has, in your book and other authors do similar things to help sort of the general public understand these issues and maybe relate to them in a way that might actually produce more impact or result or understanding of the issues.
It's a fascinating question, and it's one I think about a lot, because when you do this kind of reporting, it's really fascinating. It's like diving into a world that is secret, because it's the world of scientists. I'm not a scientist, obviously, but it's like diving into this secret world with all of this coded language and all of these little cliques of people who know stuff. In fact, silos of people who know stuff, and they don't necessarily put it together. And it's fascinating for journalists to be able to enter that world, because we're trained to look at things overall and to put pieces together of a puzzle, and that's very much what this book was. It was putting together all of these pieces of a puzzle that people had not necessarily known fit together before. And in my understanding, the way I think about it is that this is like democratizing all this information. So there's an enormous amount of publicly funded information in the heads of scientists and in their research and in their research papers, and they're trained to do all this science, but they're not necessarily trained to explain it to the public, which is, why I think it's really important for journalists to do it. So to me, it's this idea of knowledge is power. If we are able to uncover it, dive into it and figure out what it means and what its implications are, and then explain it to people, then that's got to be good for people.
So the question becomes, what do we do with the information we now have? Where are you seeing the most hope in addressing the climate change in the global ocean?
It's funny you should ask that too, because there has been this sort of refrain that has gone through the public discourse on this, and it's been this refrain of a couple of different things. One is, oh my God, this is so huge, I can't bear to think about it, or this is so huge, I can't have any effect on it, or this is already game over. That has been, I think, part of the knitted into this discourse of our worry over this in the last decade or so. And recently I've really noticed a big change, and that is this willingness, this sort of urge to realize that the ending of the story isn't written yet, that we're still in the middle of this narrative, and the end point is an unknown. We very much have the ability to turn this around. And so people are starting to, acknowledge the stomach ache and then say, but wait a sec, we can still do stuff. And so the hope that I'm stealing so much is that in small communities, this is not coming from the high levels of politics around the world. This is coming from, your neighbors and your school and, the people who are in your community saying, wait a sec, we know that there's a better way and we're going to do something about it. And what that actually looks like on the ground is really different for everybody I talk to. I mean, people often say to me, what should I do tomorrow? And I always answer the same thing. I would never dream of telling you what to do, because if you understand the problem, you'll know exactly what you can do, right? I mean, some people write plays, some people write novels, some people make art, some people write to their MP, some people start an NGO. I mean, people have a whole bunch of, incredibly powerful ways to address this. And I mean, I happen to write books, right? But people will take it in different ways, and that's what I'm seeing. I'm just seeing this massive outpouring of action from people that, in ways that are quite surprising, and that continue to give me enormous hope.
So Alex is just pointing at me and saying, "Federal politics? What about federal politics?" And I don't know. What do you think? I mean, the big issue that we have here in Manitoba around water isn't really oceans, because, we don't have any of those, or we do, but far away. But we have the lakes.
You guys have a big problem with oceans in Manitoba, and the big problem is that you need them to be healthy for everything else to be healthy. So, but I get your point.
But there's so many issues going on federally that relate to the oceans, and I guess the one thing that comes to mind right away is what's happening in terms of Arctic oceans,
right?
Around not only sort of navigation, the northern passages for transportation and navigation and shipping that are opening up and are being seen as these huge shipping opportunities and business opportunities, and also what's happening in the Arctic and the oceans around drilling and oil.
Right. Yeah, that the whole bid to take, more oil out of fossil rock, basically what we're doing there is digging up fossils and putting the ancient carbon from their bodies into our atmosphere, and that's just given what we know about the dangers there, that it would seem to me it might be a much better strategy for our country's wealth and longevity to invest the money in other things, other ways of making making energy.
Indeed, on that uplifting note. thank you very much for your book. I think, going back to the more uplifting things you were saying a couple minutes ago, it is really encouraging to see what everyone is doing. And I think there's such value in people like you who can come and synthesize these huge swaths of information and sort of tell a story that can sort of actually be understood by more people than the people in their silos doing the little bits of research. So it's really valuable, and thanks for it. And thanks for your time.
It's been fun. It's been great.
Have a good one.
You too. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
So we're going to end off this interview portion and come back to you. But first, we're going to listen to Chuck Reagan's The Boat from Feast and Famine. We call for help when the ones are
locked down. Bleeding thoughts never make a sound. Set adrift in the depths of the dark, in the heart of the sea where we wish. I feel it in my bones when the storm is cold. Then I wait for the rain and the wind to blow. As dark colors fill the sky, I'm drenched down.
The Geography and Environmental Students Association, or GESA, would like to invite you to apply for the 2012-2013 EcoGrant. Funded by GESA's efforts, this EcoGrant will award a university student, faculty, staff, or community member with up to $2,000 to work on a sustainability project on our campus. Deadlines for applications is Tuesday, November 20th, 2012, before midnight, and all application forms should be submitted via email. For access to the application form, submissions, and any inquiries, please contact GESA at GESAstudents, all one word, at gmail.com, or search for GESA on Facebook. We look forward to reading your submissions.
So we're back here on CKUW 95.9 FM. That was Alana Mitchell, the author of Seasick, and that was the second part of our series on climate change and solutions to it. What did you feel about, how did you feel about the interview, Alana?
Well, I'm just really into people that try to make science accessible, because I used to take science classes a lot when I was a university student, and it always kind of drove me crazy how hard it is to get all these really interesting things coming out of scientific research into the public sphere. So I say props to Alana for doing that work.
Next week, at the same time of 1 p.m., we're going to be back with a pre-recorded interview with Bill McKibben and a super secret guest. And by super secret, I mean I haven't lined up the last person for this interview series yet. And by saying super secret, I'm covering my butt, but then telling you all about it. Mostly because we got shifted. So I'm hoping that next week will be an indigenous perspective on fighting the tar sands. That's the ideal. And if not, it will be something as comparably interesting.
As comparably cool.
Yes.
Yes.
So we are going to end off this show before Mercy of Slumber with another song. This one will be Blue King Brown, Water. And then we're going to jump into the community cupboard. And then it'll be Mercy of Slumber here on CKUW 95.9 FM.
I don't know why, but up here I can see the walls, but my mansion's grab yourself a pen and some paper. It's time for CKW's Community Cupboard. Announcements and resources from and in your community. If you have a public service announcement or a community resource to share, contact us at 786-9782 or email ckuw@uwinnipeg.ca.
So, what we have for you with this community cupboard is So we have some storytelling events. November 3rd, Tales from the Back of the North Wind. Celtic and Norse stories told by Tom Roche and Mary Louise Chown, with music by Esme Boone on harp. Pinawa Lutheran Church, corner of Burroughs and Massey, Pinawa, Manitoba. November 3rd, 7:30. Tickets $15. To reserve space, contact mlchown at shaw.ca. November 24th, The Mosquito, a storytelling class at McNally's, four Saturdays from 6 to 8 p.m. The other ones are coming up in January, March, and April, but the one you want to remember is November 24th. The Mosquito is a new group meeting at McNally Robinson for people who love to tell stories and want a chance to share them with an audience. For those who wish they could tell stories and want to learn more about how to do that in an interactive environment, or for those of you who just want to sit back and hear the stories people have to tell, facilitated by Mary Louise Chown. To register, contact McNallyRobinson.com. Oh, for Christ's sake, November 4th at the Park Theater, 2:30 p.m. Oh, for craft's sake, sorry. You know, it's just I wanted to say, oh, for Christ's sake, and I really messed it up. Sometimes the eyes gives you what they want you. Oh, for craft's sake, November 4th at the Park Theater, 2:30 to 10 p.m., the ultimate craft show that cannot be missed. Local artisans, designers, and creators will have all of their beautiful work on display for your personal or Christmas shopping needs. Non-perishable food items are welcome as a donation to Winnipeg Harvest. Be at least 15 artisans and vendors to choose from. A select few that you can know about now are paper goodies, handmade paper cards and decorations, love notes, jewelry, vintage inspired jewelry designs, Kiki Prairie Chic, unique pre-purposed clothing and jewelry, turned out designs, handcrafted items made from exotic woods. Visit Oh For Craft's Sake on Facebook, not Oh For Christ's Sake. That's what I'm saying to myself about messing it up. And Tuesday, November 6th, 2012, 7 to 9 p.m. at Mo-